Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I want to talk about Ronald Acuña. 68 games into his major league career, he has made one thing clear. The kid is a star, straight up star. 20 years old, and after getting called up at the end of April, all he has done is rake. 19 bombs, 43 RBI, home runs in five straight games. The youngest guy in the history of the game to do that. You think of something awesome, this guy is doing it. His slugging percentage would be top five in the National League if he had enough at-bats to qualify. His OPS is right there, too. A guy who came into the season as the number one prospect in baseball is the best up-and-coming player on what is one of the best up-and-coming teams in the game right now. Big-time story. Kid's a star already. And last night, on the first pitch of the bottom of the first inning, after taking the Marlins deep from the leadoff spot on three straight nights, everybody was watching, everybody was anticipating it, and this is what happened.
The wind by Urania, first pitch, hit him. Uh-oh. Drilled him in the left elbow. Acuña walking in the direction of Urania, and now he stops. He's in a lot of pain.
Braves radio with that. And the play-by-play man said it best. Uh-oh! Let me find a way to describe what Jose Urania did right there. Let me think about this. What is a word to describe something like that? Oh, I got it. Gutless. Here's another one. Cowardly. Found another one. Idiotic. One more. Straight garbage. And for all of the hardcore, old school guys out there, the ones who talk about the code, the ones who keep tabs on all the unwritten rules of baseball, let me give you a dose of real talk right now. This is the kind of crap that makes people hate baseball now. This is something that baseball can no longer put up with anymore. Listen. Baseball's code barely makes sense on its best day. The unwritten rules of the game are unwritten for a reason. Because once you write them all down, you realize how stupid they really all are. Last night, one of the brightest young stars in the game ate a 97-mile-an-hour missile. And why? Because the guy had the nerve to do something that nobody in the history of the sport had ever done. Great look, baseball. Terrific look, baseball. And you wonder why the national pastime is having trouble keeping people interested. You should not anymore. Now you know why. Again, cowardly, gutless garbage. I mean, a garbage move by a garbage pitcher on a garbage team. Derek Jeter's crew has embarrassed themselves yet again. But not only embarrassed themselves, but embarrassed the game. You know, kind of like, we suck and we can't do our jobs, so we'll hurt you to make sure that you can't do yours either. So yes, it is a Marlins problem. Don't get that twisted. It is a Marlins problem, but it's also a baseball program a problem. And what do I mean by that? What other sport would condone this sort of crap? I mean, back up and think about it from a different perspective. If somebody were to, for instance, take a blatant cheap shot on Baker Mayfield, who was lighting it up, or maybe Sam Darnold, what do you think the NFL would do about that? If somebody were to undercut Joel Embiid or Donovan Mitchell because they can't stop them, how many games do you think the NBA would hand out? How long would a guy survive in the NHL if he took a dirty run at Connor McDavid? Only in baseball does this go on. Yeah, I know postgame. Urania said he was just trying to throw inside. I know postgame. Donnie Baseball said the Marlins do not want to be known for something like this. That the Marlins did not want to hit Acuña. Yeah, maybe they didn't, but Urania did. Nothing about this was subtle. Once again, it was the first pitch of the game, and he put 97.5 on the gun. The hardest first pitch he has thrown all season long. One of the fastest pitches he's thrown all season long. His catcher set up low and in, and it's not like Urania reacted like a guy who was disappointed that he missed his spot. So here's your bottom line. Baseball's got to do something. The standard fine and missed start or two is not enough. It's obviously not a deterrent. Not if it keeps happening. So don't come in here with one of those five-game passes, Major League Baseball. 5 games to a starting pitcher is not a penalty. It's not a punishment. It's not a suspension. It's a day off. Send a message. Send the message that you're not going to tolerate that crap any longer. Go to 20 games. Hell, go longer if you want. I'd even support that. Because what that message then says is you're protecting players. 5 games says you don't give a damn about your players. Longer says that you do. You've got a hammer, commish. Feel free to swing it. It's killing the game. And one of these days, one of these red asses on the bump are going to kill somebody. Because what we should be talking about right now is Ronald Acuña, the next great star in Major League Baseball and the guy in the middle of a historic streak. But instead, we're talking about the cowards who couldn't get him out, so they dotted him. Cowards. Because they could not think of any other way to stop him. Cowards. Cowards. It's gutless. South Central Los Angeles. Smiley. Smiley, good morning. What's up?
Hey, how you doing, Ron? First time calling. Long time listen. I just want to say baseball need to get their head out the sand. This is why don't nobody care about the game anymore. And specifically speaking for the black community, this is specifically why black kids aren't interested in baseball no more. Who wants to play? Baseball's the only game I know where if you do something good, you can't celebrate or you get penalized for it. A guy hits a home run, and I swear, Jim, it seems like he's running faster and faster around those bases. It used to be a fast trot. Now it's a 100-yard dash with their head down. Why? When that guy tipped that bat from Toronto, everybody in the neighborhood was like, yeah, that's like Kobe jammed the ball on LeBron. Everybody was fired up how he tipped that bat. But what he does, he gets criticized for it. And baseball want to know why it's lost in popularity. This is exactly why. Black kids don't want to play baseball because it's not fun. It's the only sport I know in America where you cannot celebrate for your accomplishments. It's ridiculous. And on top of that, they get a hangnail in the out 2 weeks. They only go 5 innings. They get tired on. They're a bunch of wuss. I'm sorry, Jim. Black kids in the community aren't interested in baseball anymore, and it's baseball fault. Get your head out the sand, baseball. Thanks, Jim, for listening to me. This is Smiley. I'm out.
Good job, Smiley. Rack him. We go to Kelvin in Orlando. It's good to have you, Kelvin. How are you?
Rome, it's been a pleasure, my man. Haven't spoken to you in a little over 5 years now.
Oh, no kidding. What's up? What brings you back?
Oh, what brings me back, man, are these pitchers, man. I grew up a Braves fan, too, so big thing for that. But these guys, hitting guys, you know how to stop that? If you hit a guy and hurt him, every game that guy is out, you lose a game check. Every game that he's out. So you can be out there pitching for nothing. How about that? How about if you hit that guy and he runs out there with the bat and hits you with the bat? How about that? I guarantee you they'll stop throwing at guys at that point. I would happily take my suspension if I'm a baseball player. Hit me, I'm coming out there, and I'm going to clock you with the bat. I'm going to take the rest of the year off and go fishing. How about that? That's what I'll do. And I guarantee you the next pitch will stop.
All right, Kelvin, let me respond. Appreciate you. Thanks for coming back after 5 years. We are joined by Peter Berg. Peter, good morning. It's great to have you on. How are you?
Jim, it's a pleasure, as always.
Peter, great to talk to you. I appreciate your time this morning. Listen, Mile 22 is the result of an idea that you had and then discussed with first-time screenwriter Lee Carpenter. What was the original idea, Peter, and what was it that got you so excited about this one?
Well, I mean, I think the core idea was to just make a real kick-ass action film. You know, the movies I did that you spoke of before, Lone Survivor, Deepwater Patriots, these were very intense movies. They had stories. They involved lots of people who lost their lives, oil workers, Navy SEALs, normal folks who were watching a marathon in Boston. And, those movies are very intense to make. I really respect the opportunity. I'm grateful to make them. I wanted to kind of take a movie off and just make a straight-up action movie. And we came up with the idea basically of using the CIA's ground branch, which a lot of people don't know about. You can Google it. It's something they don't talk a lot about. But it's the CIA's paramilitary organization. It's the guys, men and women, who do some really crazy, they call them black operations. They do them anonymously, and they don't have the security of the United States military behind them. And they go off and they do these extraordinary operations. So I started reading up on them, met a couple of men and women that were actual members of the ground branch, and we came up with Mile 22.
Everybody knows about the risks of driving drunk. You could get in a crash. People could get hurt or killed. But let's take a moment and look at some surprising statistics. Almost 29 people in the United States die every single day in alcohol-impaired vehicle crashes. That's one person every 50 minutes. Even though drunk driving fatalities have fallen by a third in the last three decades, drunk driving crashes still claim more than 10,000 lives every single year. Drunk driving can have a big impact on your wallet also. And the only thing tougher than paying for legal expenses is paying for legal expenses without a job. So what can you do to prevent drunk driving? Plan a safe ride home before you start drinking. Designate a sober driver or call a taxi. If someone you know has been drinking, take their keys and arrange for them to get a sober ride home. We all know the consequences of driving drunk, but one thing is for sure. You're wrong if you think it's no big deal. Drive sober or get pulled over. We're talking to Peter Berg, so you're familiar with that world. And again, we're talking, Peter, about the world of SEALs, Delta Force, Quick Reaction Force. I mean, you touched on this, but what kind of a person does it take to be willing to take on these roles in real life and successfully complete the missions that they're assigned?
Well, these are extraordinary men, and more and more we're seeing women join in the ranks of special operations. SEALs, Delta, the groups you're talking about, these are legitimately patriotic human beings who believe in sacrifice, who believe in discipline, who believe in, I think, the very best of our country. And they're remarkable human beings. If you know anything about men like Marcus Luttrell, his brother Morgan Luttrell, these I think are, the very best we can offer oftentimes as a country. The thing that's so unique about the CIA's ground branch is that these guys do it for absolutely no attention, no recognition. They're doing operations every day all over the world, and nobody ever hears about it. If they die, they don't get big military funerals. They get a star on the wall at Langley at CIA headquarters. And I find that to be fascinating. And the deeper I dove into that world, into the world of the paramilitary of the CIA, it almost struck me, certainly not as a higher form of patriotism, but a very unique form of patriotism, that these folks are willing to go out there and in often cases die for our country, and we never hear about it. And I find that to be inspirational and certainly worthy of a movie.
Mile 22 is in theaters right now. Peter Berg joining us. Now, Peter, it's your fourth film with Mark Wahlberg, so I'm going to assume that there is chemistry. There's a certain dynamic that the two of you have that's pretty special. How did you first meet him, and how did you know in that meeting that this might be a long-term special working relationship?
Well, we're both big boxing fans, and I own a boxing gym in Los Angeles with Freddie Roach called Wild Card West, and I'm a huge boxing fan. I'm certainly not a great fighter, but I still love to spar. But I'm careful about who I spar with because I'm too old to take the head trauma.
Right.
And many years ago, Wahlberg came to the gym and kind of was looking around, and I was looking at him, and we were sort of talking about doing a film, and we were both kind of looking at the room. I could see the look in Wahlberg's eyes, which, if anybody knows Mark, he's got a look. And I think he wanted to go, and I kind of respectfully declined. And Mark was like, probably a smart choice. I didn't want to go with Wahlberg. But we kind of, that was the beginning of a competitive friendship. And that turned into a professional working relationship. And, we get along like brothers now, and we're very creatively aligned. I think we both kind of look at the world in the same way. And I work hard. There's nobody that works harder than Mark, and I respect that quite a bit. So we enjoy working together. We enjoy the finished product, and it's rare that you get that opportunity in my business.
Peter Berg joining us. Peter, I'm a huge boxing guy too, so before I let you go, I want to ask you about that. But let me first ask you about Ronda Rousey, who also has a significant role in Mile 22. I've had her on the show numerous times, and she definitely has an it to her. She's got a star quality.
Yeah.
But as a star quality as an athlete, it does not always translate from sports to acting. What was it like to work with her, and what do you make of her performance?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Rhonda's, and I had my eye on her, you know, early on in her career, and certainly identified that it quality that you're talking about. It's undeniable, and I was a big fan watching her just, you know, massacre anyone that got in the octagon with her, and that was very impressive. But what really kind of won my heart with Rhonda, and made me see something, you know, more than what we saw during her success, was how she conducted herself after those two losses. You know, I think, you know, getting up and overcoming adversity are things that, you know, we talk to our kids about them. There's memes all over social media about, you know, fall down 7, get up 8, all of those quotes. It's very rare that you get an opportunity to see someone that's done it with as much grace, composure, humor, charm. You know, she went through what I think would have broken most human beings, and she didn't let it break her. She didn't let it define her, and she, you know, has reinvented herself. And I just had so much inspirational people. And her husband Travis, a class act, friends, is, you know, something that I'm very appreciative of.
Peter Berg joining us for another moment or so. Mile 22 is out right now. So, Peter, in terms of boxing, it's been such a huge part of your life, and not just as a fan or a fighter or as a gym owner. It's all the above. Who were some of your favorite fighters growing up?
Well, certainly Muhammad Ali was you know, at the top. But, you know, the fights that really inspire me, the older fights, you know, for anyone who hasn't seen the Ward Gotti fights, those were, you know, those two fighters and what they did with each other in the ring is that, you know, personifies the very best of what boxing should and can be. And the way they both conducted themselves, the friendship they had, the grace that Gotti, that Ward showed to Gotti family after Gotti passed away, I find to be incredibly inspirational. But it was certainly Muhammad Ali that, you know, as a little kid, my jaw dropped open, and I thought I was looking at a god. Probably for the first time, I felt like I really understood what religion was, just watching the magic of that human being.
Mm. Peter, one last thought. You and I could tell stories, or I could listen to your stories for an hour, but there's just one quick one. A story from a few years back. You got a call that a sewage pipe had broken at your gym, Wild Card West. You fly back from a lone survivor set in New Mexico. Nobody there to clean it up. What happened?
Well, so I was trying to start a boxing gym, and, you know, for anyone that's ever tried to start a boxing gym, they know what an idiotic endeavor that can be and how frustrating. And everything was pretty much going wrong with my gym, and things were breaking and people were quitting and all. It just wasn't going well. And I was thinking about shutting it down. I was in New Mexico filming. I got a call that the sewage pipe had broken and that there was raw sewage everywhere. And I remember asking who was going to clean it up. And my assistant told me that I was going to clean it up, that she refused to do it, but that was not in her job description. So I literally flew back, me and a friend got like rubber suits, mops, hoses, spent about 4 hours cleaning it up, and he left, and I was sitting in the gym by myself, and I realized that this was pretty much it. We were done. I was sitting there, and I in one of the mirrors, I suddenly saw someone was in the gym with me, and I saw this bright red hair. And I turned, and it's Saul Canelo Alvarez. And he's just staring at me, and he was just really starting to emerge. I was a big fan of his. And I looked at him, and he said, are you Peter Berg? I said, yes. He goes, I'm Saul Alvarez. I said, yes, sir, I know who you are. He said, can I see your gym? I said, sure. He started walking around. I think he was getting ready for Austin Trout at the time. He was getting ready. I had no idea he was in L.A. He walked around the gym. He looked at it. He said, I like your gym. I said, well, thank you. And I was like worried that it just smelled horribly, but he didn't seem to mind. And he said, do you think I could do my camp here? And I said, pardon me? He said, could I do my camp? And I said, sure you could. And he walked outside, and there were two Suburbans full of his Mexican crew. And he started yelling, and they all jumped out. They had food and all those boxing gear. They came flying into my gym, put on, like, salsa music, and just started training. And instantly my gym came back. And it was like kind of my field of dreams moment, like legitimately, that You know, I was 15 minutes from shutting the gym down, and Canelo Alvarez saved us.
Amazing. Totally surreal. The film is Mile 22. It's starring Mark Wahlberg, John Malkovich, Ronda Rousey. It is in theaters right now. He is a director, a producer, an actor, an Emmy Award winner, and a hell of a good interview subject. Peter, so good to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Good luck with that, and great talking to you, Peter.
All right, Jim, take care.
This has been a big C.J. McCollum house ever since we spoke for the first time when he was coming out of Lehigh. And not just because he's a great player. He is. Not just because he's always on the grind, always looking to improve. Not because he went from averaging just over 5 points per game to 20-plus each of the last three seasons. I mean, yes, because of all those things, but also because he's got swag, he's got great attitude, and he's got takes. Lots of takes. I always appreciate an athlete with takes. And this guy's got them. And he's not afraid to go with them. Not afraid to roast a fool or two. As an example, he's got thoughts on guys teaming up to win rings. He's not about that life. He's been very clear about this. He would not do it. He's not about that. Pretty much we all know CJ McCollum's take on this already. He's on record with it. We know it. But for some reason, people keep asking him about it. And he keeps giving the same answer. Answer being, it's not his deal. It's not something that he would do. He would not join forces with somebody else. He wants to win a ring where he is. I mean, I get it. Don't we all get that? Pretty straightforward stuff. And again, he is on record with it. But for some reason, people want to keep coming back to it. They really want to ask him about it, even though they already know his take. And even though it's not like it's some crazy hot take, a lot of people feel that way. And I'll be honest, when I saw that somebody took a run at this yet again, I was not impressed. I figured there was nothing more for him to say on that matter. That it would be the usual thing of him praising the guys on Golden State and saying how good they were, but also saying something to the effect of, it's just not something I would do. Except this time, the response was a little bit different. The response seemingly came with a little extra sauce, or so it would seem. The Score Twitter account worked up a graphic with a quote from CJ, which read, and again, I'm quoting, "I would never do anything of that nature. I think it's disgusting. I'm not built like those guys. I was raised differently." End of quote. Like I said, a little extra sauce. So, CJ quote tweets it and then added, quote, "Y'all stay bringing up old stuff. We out here looking like a bitter ex. One of the best teams ever assembled with two players you could argue are top 15 greatest to lace them up. Four Hall of Famers with another one on the way. I'm happy. Stop making me look like a scorned man. Sheesh." End quote. It's a fair response from CJ. Like, if you don't want the answer, why do you keep asking me the question? But you know how Twitter works. People are going to see that, and people are going to come for you. And somebody with the handle ChalkDelight1980, who also goes by the name Jennifer Williams, fired right back at CJ. Quote, "Win a playoff game, then talk." I mean, damn, Jen. Normally, that's where the celeb retreats to his medicine cabinet to try to fish out some ointment for that burn. But not CJ. Not my man CJ. This is why this guy's the best. Because he responded with three words that instantly went viral. Quote, "I'm trying, Jennifer." She's like, "Win a playoff game, then talk." "I'm trying, Jennifer." Twitter gold. I love that. Best response ever. And it landed perfectly. He didn't insult her. He didn't talk down to her. He just said the truth. "I'm trying, Jennifer." And no sooner than he thumbed that out, the internet lost its mind. The internet went crazy. "I'm trying, Jennifer" was everywhere. T-shirts, images of Brad Pitt chasing after Jennifer Aniston, Bradley Cooper following Jennifer Lawrence, photoshops of banners in the Moda Center, which read, "I tried, Jennifer." I'm trying Jennifer became the new Karen meme, and I get it. See, like, I'm trying Jennifer is the perfect universal response for anything that has not quite worked out the way you wanted it to. I'm doing the best I can. It just hasn't happened yet. I'm doing freaking everything I can. I'm trying, Jennifer. You're like, didn't get that report done on time? I'm trying, Jennifer. Why didn't you get that promotion? I'm trying, Jennifer. Forgot to pick the kids up at school? I'm trying, Jennifer. Didn't win an NBA title last season? I'm trying, Jennifer. Even CJ picked up on it and tweeted, somebody send me a I'm trying Jennifer t-shirt. My man, you're about to get an entire closet full of I'm trying Jennifer t-shirts. So you want to know why CJ is so cool? Because he may have just dropped the greatest tweet of the NBA offseason, and he tossed it off like a casual no-look pass in a pickup game at the Y. So stop coming for this guy. Put some respect on it, because the only thing better than his on-court game is his social game, which he is absolutely killing right now. I'm trying, Jennifer. Kyle Whittingham. Kyle, so good to have you back. Good morning. How are you?
Appreciate it, Jim. Doing great. Thank you.
Good, Kyle. Thank you. So we're 2 weeks out from kickoff. How are you feeling right about now? Are you excited to get things underway, or is there always that feeling that, you know, a little bit more time would be nice?
So we play in 2 weeks from tonight, and I'd say where we are at this point in time, we feel good about, but we certainly can use the last couple of weeks here of preparation. But we got a lot going for us. I'm pretty excited about this team.
Kyle Whittingham, my guest. All right, so in terms of the team, you've got 13 seniors, but I haven't heard you say anything but or anything about a lack of leadership. If anything, you've been really high on the leadership in that locker room. How do you explain the impact of that leadership, even if it's not from a huge senior class?
Yeah, you're right. We've got actually we only got 12 seniors and scholarship seniors, and that's the lowest amount since I've been here at Utah. And I've been here 25 years, so that's a while. But those seniors that are here, you know, those dozen guys are doing a great job at taking charge, and that started way back in January. That it was very evident early on when we got into the winter conditioning that these guys were a special group, and they've been great leaders throughout the entire time.
Kyle Whittingham, my guest. Your quarterback, Tyler Huntley, accounted for 3,000 yards and 21 touchdowns in the air and on the ground last season. But how different is he now as a quarterback than he was at this time last year?
Well, he's more polished, more experienced. You know, last year was his first opportunity to start as a true sophomore, and did a nice job for us. He got banged up a little bit, and you know, some of his off-season things that he needed to accomplish was, number one, get a little bigger and stronger, which he's done, and number two, be a little more judicious how he, you know, in his decision making, and not willing to take so many hit, so many shots. He took way too many shots last year, and he needs to be able to get out of harm's way a little bit and understand that it's better to maybe avoid a hit and you know, live to play another snap than trying to run through a 240-pound linebacker.
Yeah, that's part of the process, right? He's got to learn that. But at the same time, I've heard you call him as fierce a competitor as you've ever been around. That's really, really high praise. How would you describe that competitive fire? And in that regard, what separates him from some of the other really competitive guys you've had?
Well, he's just got a burning desire to win. He's on the field. He's got that field general mentality that you look for in a quarterback, and he makes everyone around him better. And that's really, to me, the mark of a great player, is a guy that can make everyone around him play at a higher level. And he's very demanding of himself and of his teammates, but in a positive way. You know, he's not he's very constructive, he's when he's in the huddle, you know, he's got everybody's attention. There's no doubt about it.
Utah head football coach Kyle Whittingham, my guest. You know, we're talking about growth. And as long as we're talking about growth, let me take a moment and discuss Nick Ford. Now, I mentioned him because legend has it that as a high school freshman, he was 5'8", 160. 5 years later, Kyle, he's 6'5", 320. I mean, first of all, how is that even possible? How do you explain something like that? Is that true?
Well, if unless he's pulling my leg, it's true. You know, I didn't know him back then, obviously, but when we recruited him, we heard that story that he was a late bloomer, and he's every bit of 6'5" now, and 320 pounds, and he's going to play a lot of football for us this fall, if not be a starter as a redshirt freshman. But he's a specimen now. He's got all the tools to play an offensive line, and we brought him in as a D lineman, moved him early on over to the other side of the ball, and it appears to be a great fit for him.
And listen, it would be impossible to expect somebody of that size to maintain. I mean, I could see where they might have some agility and some speed of 5'8", but how do you like this guy's speed and agility and grace for somebody who's 6'5", 320?
It's impressive. It's impressive, and that's why I think he's going to be, you know, become an outstanding player for us. He's got the quick feet. He's got the agility and balance, and he can recover. And he's the whole package. Like I said, the only thing he doesn't have right now is experience.
We're talking to Utah head football coach Kyle Whittingham. You know, you're entering your 14th season as head coach, and I bring that up because college football is a tough job. It's nearly impossible to stay in the same place as long as you have and have the kind of success that you've had. So what does that number, 14 seasons, represent to you?
Well, first of all, I can't believe it. You know, it seems like it's gone by so quickly. But what it really speaks to, Jim, is the good players that we've had come through here. A coach doesn't last that long without a lot of good players. And college football is all about recruiting, and we've been fortunate to have a bunch of guys come through this program that are talented kids that are very dedicated and committed to what we're doing. And we have a lot of guys in the NFL to show for that. I think we have 32 guys on NFL rosters right now. And so, that's really the bottom line is to get the players in here. They have the raw material that you're looking for and develop them, and that's our formula anyway for success.
You know, formula for success, that's interesting. It seems to me you have to change, you have to adapt, and you've got to be kind of nimble, but at the same time, you can't run that kind of program and have that kind of success without having a really clear sense of your identity for your program. So how would you describe the program's identity, and what do you think people think of when they think of Utah football?
Well, hopefully it's a hard-nosed, blue-collar outfit that, you know, comes to play every single week, and you're going to get the full 60 minutes from our guys. You know, no matter what happens, you know, regardless of the score or the outcome, you're going to, you know, you've been in a physical contest, and like I said, we're going to fight you for the whole 60.
Let me ask you this. The game changes, the game evolves, and there's been more and more talk, for instance, Kyle, about the possibility of traditional kickoffs being phased out of the game. What do you think when you hear that? What's your reaction?
Well, I'm a special teams guy, and I don't like that, you know, from a schematic standpoint, because I love the strategy involved, you know, in kickoff and kickoff return. But you know, as I say that, at the same time, if it's going to be a safety factor for the players and make it a safer game for them and eliminate injuries, then I'm all for it. But just from an X and O standpoint, you know, I hate to see it go away, but I think that's the direction it's headed. In fact, I don't think there's any question that the kickoff will be, you know, not part of the game in the next few years.
Let's talk Jalen Ramsey. So it's been a little over 24 hours since the Jalen Ramsey GQ interview dropped. The Shield is still tripping. My man got nice. I mean, so nice that if I didn't have so much else to cover today, I would just reread all of his quotes and then go with my same takes and my same reaction. But Jalen roasting fools. I mean, it sounds even better today than it did yesterday. You know, I'm not going to rehash that entire thing. In fact, I might. I might. I can't help it. I can't help but go back and read him lighting up Josh Allen once again. Quote, "I think Allen is trash. I don't care what nobody say. He's trash. And it's going to show, too. That's a stupid draft pick to me. We play them this year, and I'm excited as hell. I hope he's their starting quarterback. He played at Wyoming. Every time they played a big school, like they played Iowa State, which is not a big school in my opinion, because I went to Florida State, and he threw 5 interceptions, and they lost by a couple of touchdowns or something like that. He never beat a big school. If you look at his games against big schools, it was always hella interceptions, hella turnovers. It's like, yo, if you're this good, why couldn't you do better? He fits that mold. He's a big, tall quarterback, big arm supposedly. I don't see it personally." End quote. I mean, like, don't tell me that quote was not better the second time, because it was. It was better than it was yesterday. It was better than almost anything else. So the only question now is, how did all these cats who got ethered by Jalen Ramsey respond? And the answer is, not that well. Not that well at all. Josh Allen, he of the hella interceptions, hella turnovers, you're first up. You have not played a single down in the NFL, and Jalen is already looking to end your career. How's that taste? Or as my old man used to say to me, how's that grab you? Well, when asked about that, Josh Allen responded this way.
He's not on my team. He's not my teammate. It don't bother me.
He's not on my team. He's not my teammate. It don't bother me. I got to say, it's actually not that bad. That's not bad. Not that bad. Not considering that roast job that he hit you with. Not that bad. I mean, he's a rookie. He knows he has to eat it until he does take his first professional snap. Or maybe Allen knows that Ramsey is right. Either way, he did not take the bait. He did not get hooked. He checked down. Boring, but not horrible. Not that bad. Now, the irony is, as a rookie, he comes off pretty well. The irony here is the most rookie response may have come from a vet, no less a 14-year vet, Eli freaking Manning. Some of you like to refer to him as America's little brother. Not me, he's got a couple of rings. Now, this is a guy who could have very quietly, and who generally does, Eli Manning, right? Eli Manning, who deflects everything, kind of aw shucks everything. You know, America's little bro. A guy who could have very quietly simply pointed to two Lombardis. But instead, Eli, of all guys, I mean, Allen, maybe, but Eli is the one who leans into the mic and takes the super bait. If you can't keep track of the blast radius from Jalen Ramsey's nuke, he said this about brother Eli, quote, "I won't say Eli's good, I'll say Odell's good, and their connection is good," end quote. All right, so that's a guy who's won a couple of rings. But he's saying, yeah, he's not really good. I'm going to say Odell is good. I'm going to say their connection's good, but I can't really say he's good. So, yesterday, after a joint practice with the Lions, Eli meets with the media. The media could not wait to ask Eli what he thought. Most of us assumed that Eli wouldn't say jack. And, in fact, didn't. He didn't say anything until he did. Sort of. I guess what I'm getting at is Eli's crackback was predictably terrible.
Eli, Jalen Ramsey made a comment that at this point in your career, you're only a good quarterback because of your connection with Odell Beckham. Do you have any comment on that or any retort?
No. Who?
Did you get that? He said you're only a good quarterback at this point in your career because of your connection with Odell. Do you have a comment? No. No. Who? Listen to that. Listen to the lava that came spewing from Eli one more time.
Do you have any comment on that or any retort?
No. Who?
Shut it down! Let's go home! Freaking Eli Manning dropping a who. Barely decipherable, by the way. But a who blast on Jalen Ramsey. And if you couldn't tell just how damn fire that was by listening to it, Eli's extremely satisfied face after he finally spit that scud out let you know exactly how happy he was with it. No, no. Who? Eli, here's the thing. If you're going to pop off with that kind of smack, you cannot answer the solicit for that response with a no. Twice before you get to your extreme molten lava. Do you have a response? No. No. Wait. Yes, I do. Hang on. It's coming. It's coming. Wait for it. It's coming to me. Wait for it. A little longer. Who?
Do you have any comment on that or any retort?
No. Who?
Damn. Straight fire. It's like tagging your phone call to this show with, I'm out, and then warning something after you already left the stage. That response from Eli was like the equivalent of yanking on a lawnmower chain a couple of times before it pathetically turns over. I have not heard a response that bad since I asked Josh in Detroit what he had to say about the nooch cracking his ass last year.
What's going on? Thanks for the vine, Jim.
You got it. What do you make of that last call, Josh? You know, the one where the guy called you a fifth grader and hammered you?
It was good. It was good. But you know what? I wanted to tell you.
And now we finally know. Smack talk does not run in that family. Because Big Bro Pinky did not false start twice before verbally ending Mike Vanderjagt's career.
Here we are. I'm out of my third Pro Bowl. We're talking about our idiot kicker who got liquored up and ran his mouth off. So what has the sports world come to? We're talking about idiot kickers. He has ruined kickers for life. Akers and Vinatieri, these guys are great guys. They've been getting killed all week because our idiot ran his mouth. So when I get home, I'll deal with it. Tony and I talk about it. It's kind of funny, really, when you think about it. If he is still a teammate, we'll deal with it. You know, that remains to be seen. But the sad thing is, Lynn, he's a good kicker. He's a good kicker, but he's an idiot.
That's how you do it, Eli. I mean, you guys were born into the same family, same blood. Come on, Eli, that's how you do it. Listen, when you've got a couple of Super Bowls and the guy laying you out doesn't have one, the smack should write itself. No need to ad lib. In fact, just point to the scoreboard and then get to the next question. But man, this is fun, right? This is fun. Because Eli is one of a million guys that does have to respond to Jalen Ramsey. And like I always say, give me an A or give me an F. And thank you very much for the F, Eli. Team content is sincerely in your debt. Meanwhile, Matt Stafford. Now, Ramsey did not take a bat to Stafford the way he did some of these guys. Yet Stafford's wife, Kelly, took the bait after her man got somewhat dragged. In a Graham story, she posted, quote, "Can someone tell me why GQ magazine is interviewing Jalen Ramsey? I understand ESPN, but not GQ. There is nothing GQ about him. Seems like a complete waste of time and space." End of quote. Once again, I've got no dog in this fight, but I can tell you exactly why GQ interviewed Jalen Ramsey. Because of the fire that Ramsey was spitting. GQ got what Vanity Fair wanted. And Esquire, hell, shove a cigar in my man's mouth and have him join me in Cigar Aficionado. Put a circuit board in his hands and put that lava in Popular Mechanics. Does he cook? Because Bon Appetit is on line three. Good Housekeeping wants a word with Jalen Ramsey. What do you mean GQ doesn't want that? He's got nothing for them. He's got something for all of us. Hell, bring my dude on a safari and put him on the cover of National Geographic. You want to solve a magazine circulation problem? Call Jalen Ramsey. Actually, I do have a dog in this fight. Jalen Ramsey. Ramsey against the world, and I'm taking Jalen. Jalen Ramsey won. Everybody else, nothing.
Who?
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 That's the best that you can manage. No, no. Do you have a comment, Eli? Nope. Nope.
No.
Nope. 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 Who?
Who?
Oh! Shut it down! Let's go home!
Who?
He hooed. He hooed him.
Who?
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 Who? Paul Christ is my guest. Paul, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, I'm doing well.
Paul, it was tremendous to see you a few weeks back, and I really do appreciate you taking some time out of your day to sit with me and my family. Bring me up to date. How you doing? How has camp gone since then?
Well, first of all, it was. I appreciate you taking the time. It was great having you around, and obviously you got a beautiful family, and so we appreciate that. But camp's been good. I think we just finished our 13th practice, and appreciate the way that guys are going about it and working, and the season will be here soon. But it's a fun group of guys to be around, and I think they like playing, and they certainly like each other. And so just trying to make sure we finish out this phase of preparation and get ourselves as ready as we can for the season. But it's been good so far.
Paul Christ, my guest. And let me just say one more time, my family loved meeting you, and thanks for having us in there. Listen, there's a lot of buzz around the team right now and the feeling that this might be something special this year. When you see that reaction, when you see the buzz, when you see your offensive line on the cover of Sports Illustrated, is this something you like and you want to embrace? Or is there a party that maybe just kind of wants to push it aside?
Well, I think that there's I like those are neat experiences, and you know, you never want to kind of rain on their parade. And yet at the same time, none of that matters, you know, as far as what it means for this season. So I think, you know, I'd be more concerned if the players and didn't feel like the team knows that it doesn't just happen and you got to focus on, you know, each day. But as far as, you know, it's like when you play in big games, you want them to enjoy that and appreciate it. Not everyone gets those opportunities, and yet you want them to kind of stay focused on whatever that task is at hand. And I think that's the way that you can maximize and enjoy those opportunities. And so I think our players have done a good job, and we need to continue to, you know, whatever happens, just be in that moment. And so, you know, like I said, as long as they understand that that means nothing, it doesn't give them anything. But it is cool. I mean, and you want them to appreciate that, and certainly – what they've done in the past has earned some of this recognition, but none of that carries forward. And as long as they understand that, then it's all good.
And I know you made that clear to them, and it is cool. It's cool to get that kind of run. You know, it's not surprising that the offensive line would be on the cover of SI, but Paul, from where I'm sitting, this team is much more than just about that great offensive line and a power running game. There's a lot of talent at the skill positions, especially wide receiver. As an example, how excited do you get when you look at the potential of that group?
No, I do think that, you know, last year, I think they kind of grew up as receivers, and so they know that, you know, one of the best things about having a good running game is, you know, if you can be good in running the ball, then you're going to get more one-on-ones. And so the thing that I appreciate from the group is they know that it takes everyone. And, you know, you don't even look further than, I don't think we have, you know, last year we have the recognition with our line if we don't have Jonathan. And the same thing, I don't think Jonathan has the season he has without really O-line and everyone else. So I think they all understand that they need each other, and we're best when everyone is doing their best.
You know, Paul, I'm looking at this, and I read part of your resume off the very top, and I could have gone on, but it really speaks to what you've been able to accomplish in a very short time as head coach at Wisconsin. When you look back to your return to Madison, did you know that you could get this thing moving as quickly as it has, as quickly as you have, that you could get to this level this quickly?
You know, you never quite know what's to come, what's around the bend. And yet, you know, when I was here, offense coordinator, you know, I was at Pitt for 3 years, and we had really good teams and had some, you know, chance for runs the year we, you know, 2012, we got Russell, and we lose two games by Hail Marys, and otherwise that could have been different. I think, you know, Wisconsin's always had the opportunity to be in it, and you gotta make plays to win certain games. But you never quite know what's to come, and really, quite honestly, you just want to focus on making sure that, you know, the team that year becomes the best team they can be, and at the end of the year, you look up and see what it was.
Listen, I hear what you're saying. You want to focus on the team in a given year. The last thing you want to focus on is you. But there are some moments from your journey that are just too remarkable not to share. As an example, you were an intern with Mike Riley and the San Antonio Riders in the World League of American Football. At that time, you were making a couple of grand a month. And I'll bring that up for a reason a little bit later on. But a couple of grand a month, you shared an apartment, you shared a car with another assistant. What were those days like?
Honestly, they were great. You know, I mean, it was that still may be one of the best jobs I've ever had. And, you know, I was really fortunate to get connected with Mike, and certainly he was huge in the rest of my career and to this day. And yet I've been really fortunate, the opportunities that I've gotten and to be with, so many different people, whether it's other great coaches and players that you learn so much from. And so I've truly been fortunate. And yet that one job, it was a great job.
You know, Mike Riley talks about the fact that when you were working with the players, you built, quote, a beautiful player-coach relationship that was based on respect, end quote. From the outside, it seems like that's something that's been the hallmark of your coaching style. How important is it that those relationships are built on respect instead of fear or intimidation or something else?
Well, I think it's everything, and it's that's what makes, you know, for me, coming to work every day, it doesn't feel like work, and I've always felt that if you could really, you're doing your best as a coach, is if you can help them achieve more than maybe what they thought they could do, and help guide them. And like I said, there's as many, I've learned as much from players as I've probably shared with them, and so, you know, we get the game of football that kind of brings us together and connects us, but if all you had at the end was a game of football, it'd be pretty shallow. And so, again, I think I've been fortunate to be with so many really good people, and then get to do it through the game of football. I've been lucky.
Paul, Chris, my guest for a few more moments. You know, I mentioned that money because you, at that time, Don Nalen, the West Virginia legend, told The Athletic, quote, Paul is no phony. He's not in it for the money. He would have coached Wisconsin for probably a buck and a half. So, I mean, maybe not a buck and a half, but maybe, right? What is it about football, coaching football, and in particular coaching football at Wisconsin, that you love so much?
You know, I just think that it's love the, you know, you certainly love and appreciate the game, but I think more so you appreciate, you know, all that the game brings, and you know, there's a competitiveness to it, and you know, I think other sports have it, but I think football is really unique in that, you know, people that play it truly love playing the game, and it stresses you, and it's an ultimate team game, and so I think, you know, those are kind of some foundational pieces that just make it fun, and then, you know, you get to be around a lot of different guys and different backgrounds, and yet coming together, it's there's something about the whole makeup that's special, and that's what I want to make sure that, you know, you want to show your appreciation, I think, by doing your best job you can, and to keep it, you know, a great game.
So finally, let me say this, and I'm saying this not because you're here or because you were so gracious with us, but before my family and I went to Wisconsin and came to visit Madison, I had heard so much hype and there was so much love for the state and for the school that I kept telling myself and my family, man, you got to check your expectations because nothing ever lives up to the hype, Paul, except Madison and the University of Wisconsin not only lived up to it, it exceeded it. What do you remember about the first time you set foot on that campus?
Well, it was I was fortunate because I grew up in Madison, but really when I had left for high school and then came back, and it's beautiful, first of all, with the setting right on the lake, and it's definitely a big enough town that there's, you know, different things to do, but you definitely have a college feel to it, and there's an energy around here, and even in the summer, it's a good summer place, so there's kind of it's alive. And you know, in the winter we get snow and it gets cold, but it's still, people kind of embrace it and they enjoy it. And so I think there's a good balance of it offers a lot, but I think what makes it special is people.
You know, you're used to recruiting, but I'm kind of recruiting you. I'm trying to convince you. So a last thought, we did come in the summer and it's beautiful and it's right off the lake and the campus is just astonishing. What's a game day like on Saturday?
Game days are good. You know, it's in the fall, it's the Packers on Sunday and Camp Randall and Madison on game day, and people, it's an event, and we've been fortunate, we've had great support, and it really is, it's been special, and you know, you never take it for granted. I've been lucky, I've been around it for a long time, but it never gets old, and you appreciate that. And I think, you know, as a team, we talk about all the time, the best way we can show thanks is doing the best we can and playing the game the right way.
They're number 7 in the coaches poll. It opens up against Western Kentucky on August 31st. Paul, once again, thank you so much. It was so great to see you and spend some time in the facility. Thank you very much. Always good to have you on the show, Paul. Talk again soon, I hope.
It was awesome seeing you, Jim. Thanks.
Good night now!